Here on FM, it's time now for our new book of the week. The 1914 Giro d'Italia is said to be the most dramatic and gruelling bike race in history. A century later, travel writer and amateur cyclist Tim Moore sets out to tell the story by riding the exact route around Italy, all 3,200 kilometres of it. Stephen Mangan reads episode 1 of Gironimo, riding the very terrible 1914 Tour of Italy.
The true pleasure of the bicycle is freedom. You may go where you wish and when. Stop wherever takes your fancy, as carefree as a horse rider, not confined and constrained by railway carriages and timetables. The bicycle now allows us to conquer space and time. This was the quote with which journalist Paolo Facchinetti chose to introduce his account of the utterly appalling 1914 Giro d'Italia. The 1914 Tour of Italy, toughest of all time. 81 riders set off, and just 8 finished. Terrible weather conditions, appalling roads, and 400-kilometre stages proved too much for even the greatest champions of Il Ciclismo Eroica. In recent years, Italians have developed a powerful affection for their heroic age of cycling when they led the world. The Giro was, and still is, cycling's most gruelling race. Having slogged round the route of the Tour de France 12 years ago, the Giro d'Italia was exactly the sort of epic challenge I was after. A hard race which you could win on guts alone. I'd just begun to warm to my task when I made the mistake of opening Paolo Facchinetti's account of the race again. Longest ever average stage length, 396.25 kilometres. Smallest number of finishers, 8. Highest percentage of retirements, 90. Longest individual stage by distance, 430 kilometres, Lucca, Rome. Longest individual stage by time, 19 hours, 34 minutes and 47 seconds, Bari, L'Aquila. An average stage length of nearly 400 kilometres. Now, I was on the wrong side of 40. At 35, you can still cut it. At 48, you've forgotten where you put the scissors. But I was hooked by one man in particular. As depicted in the book's 1914 photos, the winner, Alfonso Calzolari, a clean-shaven, diminutive fellow with thick, slicked back hair. In the saddle, he seems frail and shell-shocked, caked in road filth, malnourished and weathered by the vicious elements. But bathed, fed and besuited for the post-victory celebrations, Calzolari looks cocksure, squat and tough. Alfonso Calzolari was born in 1887 near Bologna. With his first savings from his job in a bed factory, he bought a second-hand bike and did laps of the cycling track near Bologna station. When he was 26, he was awarded a contract with a proper team, Stucchi, one of the preeminent bike manufacturers of the time. Paolo Facchinetti based his book on a meeting with Alfonso Calzolari in April 1972. The old man brought out his scrapbook, filled with yellowing photos and cuttings, and his own handwritten reminiscences of that terrible, glorious 1914 Giro. For 3 hours, Calzolari held forth on the filthy weather and dirty tricks, the relentless mechanical and human carnage, the miraculous escapes with the hand of God upon him, the pain piled upon pain. "It was a massacre that only 8 of us survived," he said. "And somehow, in spite of everything, I beat them all." The final photo in Paolo Facchinetti's book showed Alfonso Calzolari at 90, waving from a stage in his Sunday best. I looked at it and felt a lump in my throat. His was a generation that knew what to do when the going got tough. Ever since Paolo's book arrived, I'd been captivated by its illustration of the Stucchi road bike that won the epic race. A gearless machine with chunky drop handlebars and a stout saddle. With a bike like that, I could pay proper tribute to Il Ciclismo Eroica. It was time to go shopping. The Anjou Vélo Vintage Festival was based in the winsome old riverside town of Saumur, and announced itself as a magnet for those with an interest in old bicycles. At the end of June, my friend Jim and I drove down to the Loire. I spent the morning on that fateful Saturday browsing the festival's display of fabled vintage machinery. I was halfway through haggling over some tan suede string-backed gloves when Jim nodded at a bike hidden away at the back of a pitch overseen by a pair of stubbled, bleary and very French men. "Go and check that out," he advised. I did so. It was ancient, filthy, liberally pocked with rust and unburdened with brakes. The tireless wooden wheels were horribly warped and half their spokes had rusted clean through. But it was a racer and of appropriate vintage. Jim called out to the stallholders.
"Quelle année?"
The nearest man massaged his scalp and produced a crumpled bit of paper. It was a photocopy of a page from an old bike catalogue, headed Hirondelle 1914, with a meticulous line drawing of a bicycle, labelled Number 7, Course sur route. The briefest geometrical comparison suggested the bike in the catalogue was the bike before us. Some judicious rubbing with my newly acquired glove lifted enough dirt to confirm it. I rubbed a bit harder to reveal a swooping bird. "That's a swallow," said Jim. "Une hirondelle."
"C'est combien?"
asked Jim carelessly.
400.
400 euros.
300,
I blurted. 10 minutes later, I was counting 7 50-euro notes into a blackened palm. As I shouldered it, this bike felt just right. My hirondelle was the one. This was meant to be. The festival's finale was a 1,000-strong retro ride around the Pays de Loire. As the group wobbled gingerly by, I tried very hard to imagine that in 2 months' time, both me and a similar crusty antique would be pedalling 2,000 miles. I decided that to suffer as they suffered in 1914, I must go where they went, ride what they rode, and wear what they wore. I contacted Ghisalo, the Italian wheel builders, and ordered a pair of lap-jointed beechwood wheels with the correct period profile. Next, I set about kitting myself out. The jerseys of this period were long-sleeved rollover cowl necks fashioned from heavy wool, like something you might have worn to catch deep-sea fish in the whiskey galore era. I now paid a Parma resident called Fausto to knit me a woolly jumper of plain white merino wool. The real horrors kicked in from the neck up. The photos in Paolo's book on the 1914 Giro brooked no argument. Vintage blue lens goggles and an 8-panel white linen baker boy hat were needed. The bulk of my waking hours were spent on the patio, making what could kindly be described as steady progress restoring the bike clamped in the stand. For 3 years I'd been promising to redecorate the house, and when my wife now subcontracted the task to a Polish bloke, I felt in no position to argue, though obviously did anyway. At the end of his first day, he came into the garden to clean his brushes, walking curiously around me.
"It's old," he declared at length.
I agreed.
"Why you not put in rubbish?"
My hirondelle was by no means a race-bred professional machine, and so it seemed right to leave its edges roughened. I simply rubbed the whole thing down with a damp rag and painted it with rust-proof varnish. In a state of excited dread, I tore open a jiffy bag plastered in transatlantic stamps to reveal the vintage chemist goggles with leather side shields I'd bought off a Canadian eBayer. The leather, hefty lateral blinkers plus a protective pad across the bridge of the nose hemmed the world ahead into a claustrophobic corridor that reeked of musty laboratories. They were very much improved a week later when a slightly unnerved optician replaced the lenses with much thinner blue-tinted ones. There was no let-up for our postman, a pair of plain merino wool socks, 2 metal bidons, water bottles retro-style, that baggy white linen cap, a true abomination, a pair of old woolen cycling shorts from French eBay. The elastic was going and the frayed chamois gusset had seen better days. Days I really didn't want to think about in any detail. I put them on, they fell down. One day, a sizeable package arrived from across the channel containing the shoes of fellow cyclist Gérard Lagrost. Gérard's shoes, supplied with bespoke wooden trees, were hand-hewn from stout leather,
black laced uppers, liberally perforated for ventilation, with soles held in place with rusted nails and rivets. Finally, wild of hair and eye, gasping raggedly, I staggered back and beheld the Hirondelle, raised aloft in its workstand gallows. I had done it. Actually done it. I had put together a 100-year-old bicycle, with handlebars that moved the front wheel, with pedals that went round, with a back wheel that rotated via a chain when you did so, and stopped when you squeezed a lever that pulled a cable that pressed a craggy oblong of handcrafted wine cork against a wooden rim. With trembling hands, I released the Hirondelle from the stand, then carried it through the house and out into the street. For the first time, I cocked a leg over that ancient crossbar, parked myself on that ancient saddle, eased a foot down on that ancient pedal. The Hirondelle wobbled forward into the long suburban shadows, feeling unexpectedly light and skittish. I wished passionately that the Polish painter who'd finished the job that very lunchtime was here to see this, but then the front brake cable tore right through its housing, and I was extremely glad he wasn't. With 2 days to go, I rode the Hirondelle to Lance McCormack's cycle workshop in Ealing. Halfway there, one of the pedals literally fell to pieces, cheerfully scattering the bus lane with fractured metal and ball bearings. Lance had very generously offered to give my bike a last-minute once-over. The cockeyed, cork-wobble embarrassment that was my Hirondelle's braking system didn't seem to concern him, any more than the ovoid shape of both wheels. "Anything that's bolted on doesn't really matter," he announced airily. "Just get some local fella to fix it." The next 48 hours hurtled by in a nauseous blur of panic. I rooted out the rustiest pair of toe clips and bolted them onto the pedals, then threaded them with a crusty pair of toe straps. Food, drink, spares, tools, knee-length sou'westers, the 1914 rules decreed you lugged it all. So, no spare kit. I'd washed my entire cycling outfit, socks, shorts, jersey, every fetid, woolly inch of it, every night. The probability of being refused service demanded a change of clothes for the evening. I assembled a solitary, lightweight outfit. I filled a spare pair of shoes with micro-toiletries, including a wrinkled, half-empty tube of Savlon to help with the fight against saddle sores. I wedged in two maps of northern Italy, along with Paolo Facchinetti's book. My neighbour Bernie was in her front garden. "So here's the famous bike," she said, frowning doubtfully at the Hirondelle, then at me. "Don't take this the wrong way, but are you absolutely sure this is sensible?" The postman had left a slim transatlantic stamped package. I tore it open. Inside, a bespoke black leather frame bag to go on the bike, just large enough to accommodate a wallet and phone. I held the bag up to the fading light and saw that my special request had been thrillingly fulfilled. Just above the bottom seam, stamped deep into the leather in an aptly archaic typeface, were the words, "Alfonso Calzolari." Some gland within me squirted a cocktail of raw emotions directly into my spine. Who thought this was a good idea? Not Bernie, not my parents, not me. But I knew a man who did, and his name was here in my hands.
Episode 1 of Geronimo Riding the Very Terrible 1914 Tour of Italy by Tim Moore was read by Stephen Mangan, abridged by Libby Sparrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It's a Peer production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Jane Garvey will be here with Woman's Hour.
Professor Michael Sandel visits Utrecht to ask some difficult questions.
How many think that the law should permit people to end their lives when they choose, with the help of others if need be?
And he looks to philosophy for guidance.
John Locke argued that we don't have a right to commit suicide because he said our right to liberty and life are so fundamental that even we can't choose to give them up.
A new series of The Public Philosopher begins on BBC Radio 4 tomorrow morning at 9:00.